We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
From Illinois Public Media, this is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. The deadline for filing our tax returns for 2009 is nearing. We're a little less now than 1 month away from April 15th. So this afternoon, two tax experts from RSM McGladrey Incorporated join us to answer our tax questions. I'm pleased to welcome back to this program Marty Verdick and John Breen. Marty is a CPA and Managing Director, Tax Services for RSM McGladrey. John is a Director, Tax Services for RSM McGladrey. Listeners, you may join us with a phone call or by email. Here are the phone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area. 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Our toll-free number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. And our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. WILL-talk@illinois.edu. And again, the phone number is 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. So good to see the two of you again.
Good afternoon.
You're a couple of my favorite guests.
Well, it's always fun to come back and do
this.
Yeah,
you do such a great job for our listeners. And we already have someone waiting to talk with the two of you. And this is a listener in St. Joseph on line one. Good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon. Yeah, it's always great fun to talk about taxes.
We try to make it interesting.
Yeah. Okay, so give you a frame of reference. We have a farmland. And it's included in a crop share lease, so we report our farm income and expenses on the IRS form 4835, which is farm rental income and expense sheet. And we have liability insurance on the farmland and the storage bin that's reported as an expense on that 4835. Now, we also have an umbrella insurance policy to cover twice the value of our net worth. Actually, David Sinnoh recommended that. We thought it made sense. Mm-hmm. And the value of our farmland is about one half of our net worth. So my question is, would it be acceptable to the IRS to report about one half of the cost of the umbrella insurance policy on that as a farm expense on the 4835?
Well, it's I'm not sure that you're going to find anything that's going to give you a clear answer on that. My thought would be that if the reason that you have the umbrella liability policy is because you have the farm, in other words, if the farm creates a liability that you might not otherwise have, that you want to protect yourself and your assets from that liability, I think there's a good argument that the entire cost of the liability policy would be a deductible expense. John, any thoughts on that?
Well, I would think at a minimum, you know, if it's covering, you know, half of your net worth, you would think that at least half of it should be something that you would be able to claim, you know, on the Form 4835. As Marty says, I don't think you're going to find anything definitive that's going to say, you know, you can deduct this in full, you can allocate it. But it would seem to me that, you know, at least a 50% allocation would be appropriate. Yeah.
The difficulty would be convincing an IRS agent that the reason you had the liability policy was because of the risk that is inherent with ownership of farm ground. They could easily try to make the argument that you're just insuring against general liability, slip and fall kinds of things, and you're protecting your overall net worth. So I would say that, you know, probably a conservative approach would be to allocate the cost of that policy between the farm, and so deductible on the farm versus non-deductible based on the kind of the relative value of the farm. But I don't think you would ever find any definitive guidance on that question.
Yeah, I thought it was kind of off the wall, and I just wanted your opinion. I thought I'd, after this conversation, I'd try to reach IRS on that.
Well, I wouldn't. Number one, good luck getting through. The toll-free number is usually quite a long wait. But number two, The answers that you get from the toll-free numbers are not necessarily – well, first of all, they don't stand behind the answers they give. They make that very clear, that any advice they give you over the phone is of no value with respect to defending yourself if it's subsequently disallowed.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, it has no precedential value as far as the IRS is concerned.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, thanks a lot, Marty and John. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Next, we go to a listener in Mahomet on line two. Hi.
Hi. I have a farmhouse that I rented in 2008, and the renters have moved out at the end of 2008. But then in 2009, I noticed that the floor started to sag badly in the bathroom, and I had an inspector come out, and he said the timbers under that bathroom were weak and that I had to raise the entire house up one block to have all this repairs done. I didn't do anything in 2009 because I knew it was going to be very expensive, but I still had to pay for the mowing around the house, the water and the electric, et cetera. Now, this year, I do plan to raise the house up one block, which is going to be quite expensive. I suspect I'll probably have to pay $10,000 or so to get all this repaired up. How will these expenses be handled?
Well, more than likely, that's going to be something that you're going to have to depreciate because, you know, it's not necessarily, you know, a repair from the standpoint of something that you can deduct immediately. You know, normally when you have, you know, large capital improvements, it's something that must be depreciated over a period of time.
Okay.
And if you're looking at, you know, this is a rental house.
Yes.
And you're going to be renting that again in the future.
Probably.
Yeah, the depreciation on that would be at a life of 27 and a half years.
Okay.
So you would be able to get, you know, some depreciation deductions for that. But I think as far as writing that off as a repair would probably be a little bit difficult to justify that.
Yeah, I would agree. The IRS takes the position that if an improvement such as that increases the value of the house or increases the life of the property, it's a capitalized item, as opposed to something that, you know, putting a coat of paint on doesn't materially increase the value or extend the life. But clearly what you're describing, if you don't make this repair, the property will become uninhabitable.
Right.
Yeah.
How about the expenses for mowing and electric and water and all that?
Well, as long as that property is available for rent, then you would be allowed to deduct those. You know, where you run into trouble is if you take the property off the market and it's not available for rent, then it becomes, you know, more difficult to take those expenses against, you know, the rental property. But as long as it's available for rent, then you should be able to deduct your normal operating costs associated with that.
Okay. So even though I didn't have rent last year as well as probably the first part of this year, it would still be all right to take it off, those expenses off?
Yeah, as long as it's available for rent and you're actively trying to rent that, you should still be okay with that.
Okay. I really appreciate the advice.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Next, we go to Mattoon, line four. Hi.
Hello. When filing personal income tax and you don't itemize this year, how do you get credit for your property taxes? Is there a form to fill out there? Or?
Yeah, there is a worksheet, and you are allowed on a joint return to add up to $1,000 to your standard deduction as a result of paying for property taxes. And there is a worksheet to go through that. It's in the instructions of the form. So assuming that your property taxes are greater than $1,000, you would be able to add $1,000 on a joint return, $1,000 to your standard deduction. The other thing to remember, if you're paying real estate taxes, is you are allowed a credit on your state of Illinois return equal to a fraction of a percentage, of the real estate taxes paid. Now, something that's different this year that's very easy to miss is there is a form this year called a form ICR that is attached to your Illinois return. And for the first time ever, the Illinois Department of Revenue is making you put down the permanent index number of the property on which you are claiming this real estate tax credit on your Illinois return. If you don't put that permanent index number on that form, they will reject the credit. They'll disallow the credit until you provide that number to them.
That index number is on the property taxes?
Yes, it is. It'll be on your property tax bill. If you don't find it there, many counties have a website you can go to, or you could call the assessor's office and they will give it to you. But it will be a series of two- and three-digit numbers separated by dashes. Here in Champaign County, I think It's a series of three two-digit numbers followed by a series of two three-digit. It's three two-digit and two three-digit numbers. But you can get it right off your tax bill. But be sure and first of all, don't miss the credit. And second, in order to get the credit, you'll need to put that number down. And also,
you think it might be on the tax bill?
It's definitely on the tax bill.
Okay.
Definitely. You can get it from there.
Is this form on the federal return? Does that have to be sent in, or that worksheet? Or?
No, it's just a worksheet that you use to compute it,
okay,
to compute the additional standard deduction.
This is new then this year?
No, actually, it was around, I'm looking, John.
It's been at least a couple years.
Yeah, it was at least last year and maybe the year before, but it's been around for a year or two. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's been in the instructions.
Okay, even though I thought you always had to itemize.
No, you used to have to itemize to get any benefit from your real estate taxes, but they changed that a year or two ago and allowed non-itemizers to get a limited benefit from the payment of real estate taxes. And the way they do that is by increasing the standard deduction by up to $1,000. Now, if you pay $8,000 in real estate taxes, you don't get the full benefit, but you'd get $1,000.
Is this new Schedule L, does that have to be sent in if you're using that?
Actually, that is where that gets computed.
Okay.
The Schedule L actually takes care of a couple of things. One would be the property tax amount, but there's also a new addition to the standard deduction if you purchase a new vehicle. And there are certain requirements that, you know, it can't cost more than, I think it's $49,000 or something like that. But the sales tax that you pay on a new vehicle is also an addition to the standard deduction this year, and you would also find that on the Schedule L.
I'd forgotten about the Schedule L. That does get mailed in with your return to show the calculation.
Well, that can be used for the property taxes too?
Yes.
Rather than the worksheet?
Yes. In fact, it is the Schedule L. It used to be a worksheet, and there is a Schedule L now that you use for that.
Okay. So Schedule L I could use just for the worksheet only.
Mm-hmm. And you would submit it with your return. It'll walk you right through the calculation.
Okay. Well, I'm just getting ready to do all this.
Okay. Good timing then.
Pardon?
Good timing.
Yeah, it'll take a month. Thank you.
Good luck. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Tax experts Marty Burdick and John Breen are with us this afternoon to answer tax questions. My name is Celeste Quinn. We've got some other people lined up and ready to talk with us. Next, we go to a listener on line one, a cell phone. Good afternoon. Hi.
Hi. I'm wondering, I'm an instructor at the university, and I was wondering about instructor deductions for educational expenses. In particular, I have a website that I have some personal use for, but the vast majority of the use in the web space is used for discussion sections and so on. And I was wondering if that's deductible.
Okay. What you're describing would be an expense that would be considered an unreimbursed employee business expense. That could be the cost of maintaining the website. It could be the cost of attending meetings and conferences. Basically, to the extent that you incur expenses in connection with your job as an employee and you are not reimbursed, those expenses would appear on Form 2106. It's the form for unreimbursed employee business expenses. They would transfer from the 2106 to the miscellaneous itemized deduction section of Schedule A, which is your itemized deduction summary. And to the extent that the sum of your miscellaneous itemized deductions exceed 2% of adjusted gross income, then they will be included in the calculation of your overall itemized deductions, and then you would compare that to your standard deduction to see whether you should itemize or take the standard deduction. If you do not itemize, then any unreimbursed employee business expenses don't provide you any tax benefit whatsoever. So do you itemize deductions on your individual return?
I was not planning on.
Okay. Then there would be no benefit from the cost associated with that website, because that would be considered an employee business expense, and that category of deductions would only provide tax benefit to the extent that you can include it in your itemized deductions.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Next, we go to a listener in Champaign on line two. Hi.
Hi, I just wanted to make a comment about the PIN number. The PIN number for your tax purposes is also identical to your sewer bill identification number. So when you get your sewer bill, that identification number that identifies your property for the sewer bill is the same thing as your PIN number.
Great. Well, that's good information to have. My wife pays all the bills at the house, so I never see that sewer bill. There is, in Champaign County, there is also a website that you can go to, and by putting in your street address, That information is a matter of public record, and by putting in your street address, you can not only verify the real estate taxes that were paid on that property, but also the PIN number would be listed there. And it can be, if you want to be a nosy neighbor and find out what your neighbors pay for real estate taxes, you can put in their street address. It's out there.
Well, when you get it, you actually can go down, and it shows you everybody, all your neighbors.
Yeah.
You can actually see what your neighbors are all paying for the real estate taxes. You can see if you're paying too much or too little.
Exactly.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, we talk with another Champaign listener on line three this time. Good afternoon.
Yeah, hi, good afternoon. I just have two quick questions for your guest. Number one, in Champaign County, last year I sold a house or a lot to City of Champaign, and that was under rights of eminent domain that they have. My question to you is, for my tax purposes, is that true that I have 3 years to pay for that capital gain rather than 1 year later, which is normally done, especially in the case of eminent domain? And do I have to prove to IRS that this was a case of, you know, eminent domain, and yes, there was a lawsuit, and here's the number and all those things? And I have one more question for you, please.
Okay, let me answer that question first, and because what you're describing is what's known as an involuntary conversion, and a condemnation or taking property under eminent domain fits into the involuntary conversion section of the statute, section 1033. And there is a three-year replacement window of opportunity, 3 years following the year in which this involuntary conversion occurred, for you to reinvest the proceeds into qualified replacement property. Now, are you buying – first of all, was this property personal use property, or was it trade or business property? Did you rent the property?
No. This was just a piece of land which happens to fall on the Boneyard Creek project, whatever.
Okay.
And city in that project was using eminent domain for all
right.
the property.
And
it was just a lot not used for any living.
Okay. Then you're not going to qualify. The 1030, the involuntary conversion statute says that if you have a condemnation, you have up to 3 years to reinvest the proceeds of that involuntary conversion into qualified replacement property. So in order to defer recognition of the gain, you first of all have to have qualifying property, which is property held for investment or property held for use in a trade or business. And if this could be investment property, so you could fit into that. The other requirement is that you have to reinvest the proceeds from that involuntary conversion into other replacement property. So if you don't reinvest, if you're simply going to take the cash and keep it, then the gain is taxable in the year in which that condemnation occurred. The three-year deferral rule only applies if you actually buy qualified replacement property. Now, if you think you might buy qualified replacement property and decide not to do that, you would have to go back and amend the tax return for the 2009 year when you received the money from the city. So the follow-up question that I have, are you going to buy replacement property, or are you just keeping the cash?
Okay, well, let me just update you. I've already received the money from the city because
yes.
on their books they had to close before
right.
the end of the year. So I've received the money. I might do that in 3 years. In coming 3 years, I might find a value, equal or higher value,
okay.
some investment property to make it, you know, like an equal trade or whatever. In 3 years, most probably, yes.
If in that case, if you – I mean, first of all, we're assuming this property would qualify for the deferral. And if that is the case, you would make an election with the 2009 tax return where you make the election to defer recognition of the gain. But if you do not buy qualified replacement property within that three-year period, you'll be required to go back and amend the 2009 tax return, and you will have to pay the tax that you otherwise would have paid had you simply reported the gain in the 2009 tax year.
You mean the capital gain?
The capital gain, that's right. Yep.
All right. Okay, I got that. Other quick question I have for you is also a strange situation here in town, which is in Champaign. And to be more specifically, I don't know if you remember, but a few years back when Capstone Quarters were selling some condominiums that they have 208 units right by Lincoln Avenue across from Sleepin and so on, in 2008 or so, they sold a few units, you know, in regular auction, and then came back in July and sold few other units, maybe like 30, 40 units under, you know, like no minimum bid auction, you know, like absolute auction. I along with several other people, bought a few units there and so on. And that year what they did was that they gave you 1 year tax, 1 year rent as a credit. So on your settlement sheet, they gave you a credit of 1 year rent. I'm going to make it $20,000. So whatever you paid, they give you $20,000 worth of credit on your settlement sheet, which was their advance rent until August. Now, what also happened is that for my filing taxes last year, when I checked with the accountant or the, you know, whatever tax people, they said, oh, you know, where was the income from that, who had it and all those things. And I told them I didn't receive any income. They did give a credit. Here's a settlement sheet. But she was thinking that that was like a regular income, should be reported. On the other hand, Capstone Quarters, their office in Alabama, really never issued a 1099 to us showing that as income. So my question is, it's a dilemma. I have not received 1099 from, let's say, Capstone Quarters, so it was not an income to me. It was whatever was a credit on the thing that showed on settlement. How do I report that?
Well, you've described a fairly complicated transaction, and
yes,
one that I would want to take a look at before giving you any definitive answer. But my initial reaction is that the credit that they gave you, it sounds more like a purchase price adjustment. And so my initial reaction is, rather than I believe what you may have is a situation where you've got a $20,000 lower basis in the property and you would have that rent income. But that's one I would want to take a look at in more detail, because it's a fairly unique transaction and not very common.
That is correct. That's why the complication is, because I'm myself in real estate and I'm, you know, also looking at it. Settlement just shows $20,000 whatever credit at closing, and that I don't know if it was towards purchase price or whatever, because you bought it in auction with whatever the price was, and then you know, like they were also supposed to give you prorations on taxes and rents and all those things, and their proration was that they give you the credit for whatever the time that they, you know, the property was, let's say 12 months. And on the other hand, because from my point of view, because of the fact that they never issued a 1099 that year, to me that was not income.
The fact that you didn't get a 1099 is not determinative. The 1099 is a filing obligation of the payor, but the code, the Internal Revenue Code, says all income from all sources. It doesn't say all income from all sources if you get a 1099. So I wouldn't place a lot of weight on the fact that you didn't get a 1099. And what, in order to answer your question, it's something that a tax specialist would need to look at the settlement sheet and really understand the transaction. It's beyond the scope of really what we can do on the phone today. I wish I could help, but I'd really need to see the documents to be able to give you a definitive answer.
Will the settlement sheet tell you a lot about it?
The settlement sheet and the contract. It you'd have to look at both of those things and read them very carefully to see what exactly you've got.
Okay.
I was going to say that, you know, settlement sheet is one thing. Contract, or a regular contract, when you're a sale of property, never says that any prorations of water will be given.
Now, I realize that, but it probably contains some information that might be helpful.
Yeah, and we're going to have to leave it go at that, and we're going to take another call. Listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hello there.
Hello.
I have a question about next year's taxes.
Okay.
There have been some things in the media about energy improvements you make on your household. Can you talk about that and give us some information on how that works?
Yeah, there's actually several different energy credits that are out there. Probably the most common that people are familiar with would be things like if you purchase, you know, new exterior doors, new exterior windows, new energy efficient furnaces, water heaters. Those are some of the prime examples of a credit that is the maximum amount is $1,500, and it's based on 30% of whatever the cost of those improvements are. So if you spent, you know, $3,000 putting new windows in your house, you would get a credit of $900 because you're going to get 30% of whatever the cost was, up to a maximum of $1,500.
Okay.
Now, that's the most common. Now, there's also some other credits that are out there if you decide to put solar into your house or if you use, you know, geothermal energy. Those credits really do not have a dollar limitation. It's still a 30% credit, but you're not limited by the $1,500 if you go with, you know, those type of items. And generally, you know, those are going to be significantly more expensive. And also the return on the investment is normally, you know, pretty high with those from the standpoint of, you know, how much you're going to save by putting in geothermal or solar.
John,
thanks a lot.
John, explain the difference between a credit and a deduction for their benefit as
Oh, sure. A credit is basically something that is deducted directly from your tax. So, you know, when you prepare your return, you know, you have your income and you subtract off things like your itemized deductions and your exemptions, and you get to a taxable income number. You then calculate your tax based on that taxable income, and then a credit would reduce dollar for dollar that amount of tax. So when we're talking about a $1,500 credit, it would be a $1,500 reduction in your tax, assuming that you have at least $1,500 of taxes that you're paying. A deduction, on the other hand, if you received a deduction of $1,500, that actually just reduces your taxable income. So what you have to do to calculate how much a deduction is actually saving you is you determine what tax bracket you're in and multiply that by the amount of the deduction to determine how much tax you're actually saving.
And I believe that there is a website that you can go to that the government has up. It's called EnergyStar.gov, which mm-hmm. also would spell out some of these things as
yep, exactly. As well. It is EnergyStar.gov, and it has a lot of – it's got a frequently asked questions section. It talks about the different kinds of things that would qualify. And that $1,500 credit is a credit over a two-year period, 2009 and 2010 combined. So a person cannot double up on the credit by doing some work in 2009 and some work in 2010. So in preparing the 2010 return, you'll need to remember how much credit, if any, that you claimed on the 2009 return, and the $1,500 credit is cumulative.
Okay. This is the Afternoon Magazine Tax Experts. Marty Verdick and John Breen from RSM McGladrey Incorporated are with us this afternoon. My name is Celeste Quinn. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Toll-free 800-222-9455 if you'd like to talk with us. By email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, let's talk about another credit. This is Making Work Pay credit. What is that?
Okay, that is a new credit for this year. It is one that is easily overlooked because it is new and people haven't seen it before. It is a credit for those people who are working. The credit is equal to 6.2% of earned income. There is a phase out of the credit for individuals, single individuals with income over $75,000, married if the income is over $150,000. But let's assume for a second that a person, and by the way, the cap on the credit is $800. So if a person made 20 or let's say $30,000 in wages, they would qualify for the full $800 credit. Now, there is a caution here for those people who are receiving Social Security benefits or certain railroad pensions or federal pensions. Those people should have received a $250 per person advance payment, if you will, on this credit or an economic stimulus payment last summer. I think it was in June that that money went out, June or July. That is a reduction of this $800 credit. So we have clients who not only are receiving Social Security benefits but are also working, and they would be eligible for the credit based on their earned income up to $800. But if the taxpayer, let's assume a married couple, if the taxpayer and spouse both received the $250 advance payment, then there would be a $500 reduction in that $800 credit, leaving a net of $300. So two things unique about this credit: since it is new, it is easily overlooked. And if you do catch the credit, it's also easy to overlook the fact that there could be a reduction in this credit if you received the advance payment on the credit, and that would have been paid to people generally who are receiving Social Security benefits, federal pensions, and railroad retirement benefits.
So where do we look for this on the forms?
The credit is, it appears right below the withholding line on page 2 near the bottom of your 1040. So form 1040, page 2, down in the bottom section where the other payments like federal withholding and estimated payments are listed, that credit appears right in that section.
Okay.
And it's actually Schedule M is what you complete. And if you fill out the Schedule M, there's a line on there that talks about, did you receive a $250 economic recovery payment? But I think what's happening is that probably a lot of people are overlooking that as they're calculating, you know, their Schedule M.
And I believe that payment for Social Security recipients, if they're having their Social Security benefits directly deposited into the bank account, I believe that payment was also direct deposited. And many people don't remember that they got the payment,
sure,
because it just went straight into the bank account. It wasn't like they got a check from the government. So you can actually, if you're unsure, you can actually contact the Social Security Agency, the Social Security Administration, and they'll be able to tell you whether or not you received the payment.
Okay, very good. 333-9455, the number to call in the Champaign-Urbana area if you'd like to talk with our guests. 800-222-9455 is the toll-free number. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. I suspect that for most people who have been fortunate enough to find a new house or to be moving, they've got a nice big break for home buyers, and this is, it started out for new first time only home buyers, and now it's been broadened. So
yeah.
what's the lowdown on that?
Well, yeah, actually there's two different credits, and these are tax credits, not deductions, as we were talking about earlier. The other thing that's interesting about these is that they are fully refundable. And what that means is even if you have no tax liability, you are still eligible for getting these credits back in full if you qualify. The first one is what's called the first-time homebuyer credit. And this has actually been around for a couple of years. It started off 2 years ago as a credit that people had to basically repay. It then turned into an $8,000 credit that you do not have to repay, provided that you live in the home for at least 3 years after you purchase it. You're allowed a credit of either $8,000 or 10% of the purchase price, $8,000 being the maximum that you can claim. There are several attachments that have to go with the tax return in order to claim this credit. And so what we're finding is that a lot of people are not aware of this, and so when they come in, we have to kind of walk through the list of here are the things that you need to attach to the tax return, because what was happening was that people were claiming this that were not truly eligible for the credit. I think there was a story that went around about a four-year-old that actually, you know, had claimed this credit on a tax return. So as a result, the IRS has had to put some things in place to basically say, okay, you need to prove to us that, you know, you've actually purchased this home and you are buying it. So the first-time home buyer is probably the one that people are most familiar with.
And that has been extended. It was scheduled to expire. It has been extended, and it currently is available for people who have a home under contract by April 30th and close by June 1st of this year, and then it is scheduled to expire. So we've just got to you know, another 40 days or so to take advantage of this credit.
Okay. And then also for people who have been in a home for, I believe, it's a period of at least 5 years,
right,
and
mm-hmm.
they are moving into another home, they're eligible for a tax credit,
right,
as well.
Right. This is a new credit. It is a move-up or repeat home buyer credit that was new in 2009. It is a credit of $6,500, so slightly less, but still very attractive. In order to qualify, you have to have lived in your former residence as a principal residence for a minimum of 5 out of the 8 preceding years. So if you have someone who's lived in a home for 5.5 or 6 years, they sell that home, they buy a new home, they would qualify for this move-up or repeat home buyer's credit. The same deadline of April 30th to be under contract and June 1st to close applies. But it is a $6,500 refundable credit, just like the first-time homebuyer credit. And for someone that's buying a starter home, you know, if you buy a starter home for $120,000 and you get an $8,000 tax credit, that is a very significant incentive. And it has been very effective. Right before this was originally scheduled to expire last year, in talking to some realtors, they saw quite a push for first-time home buyers to actually get into the market. The combination of low interest rates plus this credit, I think, was very effective.
Yeah. Let's take a call now. A listener in Vermilion County on line 4. Hello.
Hello. I hope you can clarify something about qualified dividends for me. My income, about a fourth of my income, comes from dividends, and most of those are qualified. And last year, I did not take the mandatory distribution from IRAs and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And last year I had grossly overpaid my estimated taxes, and so I left about $1,000 in. And now this year, when I do that qualified, by the time I finish with that qualified dividend worksheet, I owe no taxes, and I just can't believe this.
Well,
I've done it three times.
Yep, believe it. It is true. The qualified dividends, first of all, are not all dividends are qualified, but if they fit into the category of qualified dividends, and it'll tell you right on your Form 1099-DIV if it's a qualified dividend. If it is a qualified dividend, normally the maximum rate of tax on that is 15%. However, for certain taxpayers whose income falls below a threshold, the rate of tax on those qualified dividends and also long-term capital gains can be zero. And because you didn't take your required minimum distribution from an IRA or other retirement plan, that undoubtedly dropped or it apparently dropped your income low enough that, in fact, you are eligible for this 0% rate of tax on these qualified dividends. And this is a I've seen this happen a number of times. And the first time I saw it, I will admit I did a double take and made sure that it was doing it correctly. But, you know, without working through the math with you, I can't say whether or not your calculation is accurate. But I would tell you that it is an answer that is entirely possible. And John, you've probably run into this already as well, haven't you?
Oh, yeah. We've actually seen it for the last couple of years. And like Marty, I was the same way. The first time I saw it, it's like this can't possibly be right. But, you know, our software generates what's called a Schedule D worksheet, and it walks through the calculation to show, you know, how it's arrived at. And, you know, depending on your situation, it's very possible that you could end up with a zero tax liability.
Yeah. And
last year, because of that, I left in a hefty portion of my mm-hmm. overpayment because right. I thought, maybe I'm wrong. And now this year, I not only have that, but then the amount that was deducted. Well, then that leads to another question. How can I predict what my qualified dividends will be? What makes them qualified?
Well, in order to be qualified, it needs to be a dividend essentially from a U.S. Company paying dividends out of its earnings and profits. So, for example, a dividend that you receive on a money market account would not be a qualified dividend. But if you own shares of stock in a company, or if you own a mutual fund and that mutual fund owns shares of stock in a company, most of those dividends would likely be considered qualified dividends. Now, in a mutual fund, the fund will sell investments internally, and if those gains from those sales are short-term capital gains, they include them in the dividend total and they are non-qualifying. The best predictor you, I think, could have would be to take a look at the prior year information and assume that the ratio is going to be approximately the same, but there's
so
no guarantee it's going to be.
Has dividends that are entirely qualified last year, then I can assume.
Yes.
Because I keep charts of it.
Yep. They'll be, if you've owned stock in a company directly, it's very, very likely that that dividend would be considered a qualified dividend.
Well, thank you very much. That relieves my mind completely.
Okay. You're welcome.
Next, we talk with a listener in Effingham on line one. Hello.
Hi. My question is about new home building. Maybe someone has asked this already. I just tuned in. But if you're building a new home, are there any tax credits for you?
Well, there certainly would be. I mean, we did touch on this a little bit earlier from the standpoint of, you know, there would be some energy credits that you could possibly qualify for.
Right. I heard that. But in terms of, like, the tax credit for new home buyers, I mean, do you get something?
How quick will the home be constructed, I guess, would be the question there.
Well, the construction loan would pre-process by April 30th, but the home wouldn't be probably finished until Christmas.
No, that won't work then. New construction does qualify for the first-time home buyer credit. However, the same rules apply with respect to it has to be under contract, and you would have a June 30th date for completion. So if it's not done until fall, you would not satisfy the date requirements. So new home construction can qualify, but the April 30 and June 1st dates do kick in.
So you wouldn't be able to use a construction loan for the tax credit?
No, no. The fact that you have a construction loan would not satisfy the requirements to claim the credit.
Any chance they might extend that?
There's always a chance it's been extended twice already. Every time it is scheduled to expire, they extend it because it has been very effective in encouraging home construction and home sales. But at this point, I've not seen anything in any of the tax bills or extenders that would do that. But that can change any time.
Okay, great. Thank you.
You're welcome. Next, we go to a listener in Champaign, line two. Hi.
Yes. I have an unusual kind of tax question. My husband owns a small farm, and he does not take part in any part in the actual operation of it. But so we have farm rental income. Well, this year, in 09, rather, we did not sell any crop during that season year. And so we have a loss, basically,
okay,
after taxes and all of the other expenses that went into it. We do not cash rent.
Okay, so this is a crop share arrangement.
Right, it's a crop okay. share arrangement, and we do not cash rent, and we did not sell any crop during 09.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I did see that we needed to complete a Form 8582 to determine the loss.
Correct. This would be, first of all, you would do the Form 4835, which I'm sure
right.
is what you've been filing.
Right.
Now, the issue with the Form 8582, though, is what type of activity is it? And if this is rental of bare land, which in essence is what it is, then it does not qualify for the passive activity loss rules.
On the income side.
On the income,
yeah,
right.
If you have income. But if you have a loss, you still be subject to it.
Okay. Where then do I put the loss?
In terms of the section of the form?
Yes.
Well, let's walk through this. If and John is our resident farm expert, but if there's income, there's a recharacterization rule that says the income is not passive income. But since you have a loss, and it's from a business activity in which you do not participate, it would still be subject to the passive loss rules, would it not, John?
Yeah, it would. The question is, we're not going to be subject to the $25,000
right.
residential rental
right.
rules. So the problem with it is going to be that unless you have other passive, you know, activities that you could net with this, that loss is going to be limited in the current year.
Okay, can we recapture it in the future years?
What would happen is that when you then claim income on this in the future and, you know, let's say that next year you sell, you know, a significant amount of your crop, then you would be able to use the loss from this year and net it with the income that you have from next year.
Yeah,
so it doesn't, you know, it doesn't go away. What happens is that you basically put it on hold for a year or until the next year that you have income, and then you're able to reduce the income by the carryover loss that you have from that activity.
Okay.
It's called it's called a passive loss carryover, and it does you do use a Form 8582
right.
to work through that.
I did get – is that under Part 1, 3?
I'd have to have a form in front of me, but I believe it is.
I think it is Part 3.
Yeah, I think it's yeah.
Because Part 1 would be the residential rental.
Actively managed rental real estate. Yeah.
Right. And so, yeah, I think that Part 3 is going to be the correct spot for that, and it should limit that loss unless you would have some other passive income.
Okay. We don't have any other passive income.
Okay.
Okay. Then you will be subject to these limits.
Okay. And we have to file this report with this year's taxes and then carry it over for next year.
Right. You'll file one this year to limit the loss and file one next year to claim the loss.
Claim the loss. Okay, reclaim it next
yep.
year. Okay, well, it was one of those years that we just didn't sell any crop. We waited, and it was you know, I usually do our taxes, and I ran into this, and I thought, well, I don't exactly know where to file it on these
yep.
papers. So,
yep.
thank you very much for your information.
You've
been a great
welcome.
Help. Okay, bye bye.
Bye. Thanks for the call this afternoon, and we're going to have to wrap up here pretty quickly. We've got one call I don't think we'll be able to take this afternoon because we're right here on the at the end of time. I did want to mention, though, I did a little research before the show, and the HOPE credit, this is if you've got a child or children in college, this is a nice credit. The HOPE credit is now the American Opportunity Credit, and it's increased and expanded.
Yeah, it is, and John, we'll both kind of comment on this. The it is limited to the first
4 years.
4 years of college education. The one nice enhancement that they've made is that a portion of the credit may now be refundable. And by that, it, as John explained earlier, many tax credits are only available and provide benefit to the extent that you have a tax liability. But this new credit, they've changed that so that a portion of that credit is now actually a refundable credit. So even if you have no tax liability, if you are eligible for this credit, you would get some money back from the credit. And that's the enhancement that and it's a significant credit. For those people who are eligible, it is a very attractive tax credit.
Okay.
And the lifetime learning credit is still out there for people who are in grad school or have exceeded their 4 years.
Okay, very good. And one last question, and then we'll wrap it up. Last year, those who didn't itemize got a tax break on property taxes. Does that remain in effect this year?
Yes, we were talking about that with the Schedule L.
Okay.
That's where that comes
right.
in
okay.
With that calculation.
Okay, very good. Well, there we'll leave it. I want to thank the two of you so much. And come the next tax year, maybe we'll be doing this program on Focus rather than the afternoon.
That's what I understand.
Okay, very good. My thanks this afternoon to Marty Burdick and John Breen of RSM McGladrey Incorporated.